This is an ABC podcast.
This is Baby Talk Podcast with Penny Johnston.
One in six Australian couples is going to experience infertility. 5% of babies born in Australia are born via assisted reproductive technologies. So it will come as no surprise that our $560 million industry is growing at a rate of 5.6% per year. So with the big IVF firms listed on the stock exchange, are patients getting treatment that works or treatments that bring in the profits?
Someone had some success with one particular treatment, whether, you know, if it was endometrial scratching or acupuncture or natural killer cell therapy or whatever it might be. It was the one thing that they tried and that coincidentally was the thing that was the cycle that they had success with. And so you have people coming into the offices and saying, look, I really, really want this one.
This week, the ABC launches a huge investigative project called Making Babies. And while many people will be surprised by the numbers, the sheer size of people taking part in the IVF industry, you know, one child in every school classroom is statistically conceived with assisted reproduction. What many of us also know is that every single treatment, every conception, every failed cycle and every birth is incredibly important to the one couple who are hoping against hope. They're not going to be just another statistic. Ben Knight from ABC News is one of the lead reporters. Ben, thanks for talking to Baby Talk. I know that some of our audience have been contributing to the project already. How did the ABC investigative team decide to turn their spotlight on the fertility industry?
Well, the idea came from some senior editorial people at the ABC who, I think, had just been talking amongst themselves about issues relating to IVF and fertility, because a number of them had been through it. And like all of us, they all know someone who'd been through it. And just realised that the reporting that we'd been doing on it was pretty piecemeal. Things come up, stories come up, we report them, and you know, we obviously try to do the best we can, but then they sort of fade away again. And mostly they're of interest to people who are directly affected. But it's just such a fascinating area, and it touches so much of our lives that we really thought it was time to put together a proper project and take a big deep dive into it, because it's so widespread. 5% of the children who are born in Australia are born through some kind of assisted reproductive technology. It's a huge industry. It's been rapidly commercializing, but essentially it's been allowed to run its own race. It's largely self-regulated. Four Corners took a look at the fertility industry in Australia a couple of years ago in 2016. And looked at what were some pretty concerning issues at the time, mostly around the kind of information that women and couples were given about their chances of success, which, as you would know, once a woman enters her 40s, they really nosedive. They just fall off a cliff. And whether women and couples were being given proper information about whether it was worth them continuing on when the percentages or the chance of actually having a baby through IVF was close to zero. And not a lot changed after that, which, as you would know, is pretty unusual for Four Corners. And so it's just sort of plugged on since then. And there are just so many interesting things to look at. So we thought, look, let's dig up a couple of things, turn them into some what we think are some pretty solid news stories, generate some conversations, and use that as a way of throwing it open to the remarkable ABC audience and hear what their experiences are and what they think that we should be looking at. And that's exactly what's happening.
Some of the things that might really surprise people is that this infertility industry is huge business. We're talking listed on the stock exchange type companies.
Yes, and Australian players are international players as well. There are three very big players in the Australian market. And the big Australian players are international as well. I mean, obviously, we have a really solid history of IVF research in Australia. Some of the pioneering technologies of IVF were developed here in Australia. But since then, the regulators will tell you it's become rapidly commercialised. So the way that the system works here is that you will go to your fertility specialist. And more often than not, they are connected to one of the big IVF players, such as Virtus Health or Monash IVF, And there are a number of clinics that have different brand names, but usually they belong to one of the big three. But the specialists themselves really tend to run their own race. And that is one of the things that we took a look at here, because essentially it's up to them which treatments they offer, how they want to go about it. So the big players themselves, the big companies, don't really get to tell the specialists what they should and should not be offering. And that was the focus of our first story, which we've just published, and which really was the kickoff for this whole project. Because there's a bit of concern that there are some technologies out there, some of these add-on technologies, which are not covered by Medicare. They can be extremely expensive, and that there's not a lot of science behind.
Did you actually find that these companies were perhaps putting profits ahead of ethics when it came to offering these sorts of add-ons to people?
No, we didn't, because it's not really the companies that are offering them, it's the individual specialists. And, I certainly don't have any evidence to say that certain specialists are doing that. And in fact, some of the specialists that we spoke to talked about the pressure that actually comes from their clients, from the patients who are going through it, that they will have heard, whether it's through a Facebook group or through, conversation with a friend or just something on the grapevine, that someone had some success with one particular treatment, whether, if it was endometrial scratching or acupuncture or natural killer cell therapy or whatever it might be. It was the one thing that they tried and that coincidentally was the thing that was the cycle that they had success with. And so you have people coming into the offices and saying, look, I really, really want this one. And then you have the specialist who's in a position, should they be, to say, yeah, we don't know if that actually works or not. We just don't have enough research. So it's expensive, but I cannot guarantee that it'll work for you. But still the pressure that comes from patients who are just adamant that this is something that they want to do. Because as I'm sure many of your listeners would know through their own experience or whether it's people that they know, people are desperate. They're willing to try anything. And if they've committed the resources to it, if there's just the slightest chance that something will work, then people are going to want it. And so the difference is that in Australia, we don't really regulate that. We don't say there's no sort of central repository of information for people who are going through IVF to have a look at some of these treatments and get an independent assessment of whether they're actually worth spending the money on. Now, that's very different to the situation in the United Kingdom. The Panorama program on the BBC, which people might know is roughly equivalent to what Four Corners do in Australia, in 2016 did take a look at that, and they got the Oxford University Centre for Evidence-Based Medicine to spend a year looking at the science behind some of those most common add-on treatments, like natural killer cell therapy, like endometrial scratching, like pre-implantation genetic screening. And what it did was find that there really was not a lot there. And in some cases, what little research there was indicated that some of them could even potentially be harmful. Now, that led to a pretty significant change in the UK. There is a federal regulator in the UK. It's called the HFEA. Their initial response to the Panorama program was a bit snitty. They said, look, no, we're doing fine, thank you. We don't need to change anything. But that pretty quickly changed when you had fertility specialists of the caliber of Lord Robert Winston saying that the regulator had absolutely dropped the ball. And so what the HFEA then did was to pick some of the most common add-on treatments, take a look at the science behind them, and give them a grading system on a sort of, it's a traffic light system. So it's pretty obvious how it works. If something gets a red light, that means that there is either no evidence behind it or, no evidence and it could potentially be harmful, but certainly no evidence that it works. An amber rating for a particular treatment says that, look, we don't know if this works. More research needs to be done. So if you're going to undertake this particular treatment, do so on the understanding that we have no idea if this is actually going to work or not and won't do until we do more study. And of course, the green meant, yep, we know this works. The research has been done. Go for it. None of the add-on treatments, none of them got a green rating. There were half a dozen on the amber list and half a dozen on the red list. Now, that was 2.5 years ago. many of those treatments that are on the HFEA's red and amber list are available here in Australia. And it's really up to your individual specialist to inform you of the science behind them. And that does not always happen. In fact, only Victoria is the only state that requires specialists to lay out that kind of information. So you can go onto the websites of some of the big clinics and you can see some of these treatments being openly promoted, and there's very, very, very little information to tell you that, in fact, this is pretty experimental and the research hasn't been done and we don't really know if it works.
Wow. And, of course, this is all the science behind it. This has nothing to do with the emotion of desperately, desperately wanting a baby. And suddenly your head's in a whirl with making all these choices and you'll do almost anything to make it happen.
Yeah, and spend thousands and thousands. And, of course, that is where that's where the problem lies for a number of people. Look, if you have the resources to spend on that, then great. Good luck to you. Try anything you want to do, but be aware that you could be getting some more information on whether it's actually reducing your chances of having a baby, and you should certainly do that. There's, of course, a bigger concern there about the number of people who just simply can't afford to keep trying cycle after cycle. This is, I guess, where we want to take the reporting next. We want to look at those issues of access. We know that public IVF is coming in Victoria and also in New South Wales. We know that there have been a couple of low-cost IVF providers who have entered the market, and that's great. But even then, the out-of-pocket costs per cycle can still be in the hundreds or up to $1,000. I mean, there's just simply a lot of people who don't have those kinds of resources to keep going and going.
And, of course, there's the public bill too, because Medicare still kicks in a big chunk.
And we have no restrictions on that either. So, Australia's pretty unusual in the world in that we don't put a limit on the number of cycles that Medicare will support. And the Medicare support per cycle is pretty significant. So I think it's about $3,700, but with a Medicare safety net, it can go over $4,000. So you can, as many times as you want to have a cycle of IVF, you can get Medicare support for that. Now, a lot of other countries don't go anywhere near that. Also in Australia, there's no age limit on women who want to go through IVF. And that also very unusual by world standards. And you can understand why, because the figures are pretty stark. Once you hit 42, your chances of conceiving through IVF drop to below 2%, and they just keep going down. Also, with the number of cycles that a woman has, the more cycles that she has, the chances of conceiving progressively go down. That's just what the data say. So we have this very generous system in Australia, and we want to make sure that it's being spent as effectively as it can be, and also making sure that perhaps we're not spending money on cycles that have a very limited chance of success when there are people who have a good chance of success who aren't getting access to IVF because they just don't have the resources. So that I think is a discussion that's coming. One of the things I think we're also expecting to hear about is people's experiences within the system. One of the common complaints that we hear is that if you're going through IVF, it can be very, very difficult to get through to the clinic, to contact the clinic when you need them. If you have questions or if you have concerns, you can call, you can wait, you can send emails. It's very, very difficult to get a response. But when the bills are due, the calls come very, very quickly. And people do have concerns about some of the treatment that they've got. Now, this is not to say that this is endemic throughout the IVF sector. Clearly, it's something that a lot of people use, a lot of people have terrific results with. But yeah, absolutely, it's very emotional and it's very stressful. And a bad experience can become a really traumatic experience if it's not handled correctly. And again, this is a sector that has essentially been self-regulated, allowed to run its own race. And while there have been no major disasters, there are some things I think in there that are worth taking a closer look at. And people's experiences, where they probably haven't had a chance to talk about them at this level before, that's what we're after.
Although you're saying that the industry has sort of developed on its own, you haven't really uncovered that there's blatant money-making. It sounds like the people that are working in the field are just as passionate about getting babies into people's hands as the parents are.
Look, the feedback that we get from fertility specialists, even those who are critical of, you know, some of the things about the industry at the moment, is that, yeah, look, absolutely, people are in this for the right reasons. The majority of people are in this for the right reasons. But some people have really had poor outcomes. People have been through some traumatic experiences when things have gone wrong. And what is the recourse? What is the complaint system? What can they do about it? Those sorts of things just don't seem to be in place at the moment. Also, it's going to be looking at things like access. I mean, there's a statistic that something like 50% of the Medicare rebate goes to 25% of the people with the highest income in Australia, simply because you have that disparity with resources. So look, things are changing. Access is improving. But if there are still things going on, like clinics using particular techniques like intracytoplasmic sperm injection, which is, we'll call that ICSI for short, which research is increasingly showing, if it's offered to the wrong people, if it's offered to couples where there's no problem with male infertility, it can actually reduce their chances of having a baby. And yet Australia has one of the highest rates of this particular technique in the world. So how has that been allowed to happen? You know, regulators are looking at this. They want it to come down. Experts are looking at this. They say, look, we really need to rethink this. But what's the mechanism for that to happen? We just haven't had that deep dive, that really good look into the industry, and had that public conversation about what we need to be thinking about.
The big difference between the US system and the Australian system, I mean, apart from cost, is that infertile couples in the United States have access to a whole range of options that are very limited in Australia. I'm talking about egg donation, surrogacy, embryo donation. Are you going to cover that really tricky area?
Absolutely, yeah. In fact, we have a couple of stories that we'll be rolling out pretty shortly on exactly those sorts of issues. Yep, no question. And look, you talk about the American experience, and that's a good story for the self-regulation of the IVF sector in Australia to tell. I mean, because you don't have any public support for IVF in the United States, when people have a crack at it, they tend to want to make absolutely sure they have the best chance possible. And so that's where you get the multiple implantation of embryos. And that's where you get what we used to have in Australia, but we don't have anymore. And that's multiple births. So twins, triplets, quads, quintuplets. Now that basically stopped in Australia through self-regulation, through the industry saying this is not what we want to be about, because the health outcomes for those children and the financial outcomes for the parents have just been abysmal and very expensive. So we haven't done that in Australia. And that's, you know, I guess, like I say, it's a good story for the IVF sector in Australia to talk about how well it's regulating itself. But there are some other issues out there, and I know we're going to hear about them. We've already had hundreds of responses to the survey, and we're expecting many more. We're now in the process of going through them. There'll be issues about donor eggs. There'll be issues about surrogacy. There'll be all sorts of things that we probably haven't even thought of yet. Mm-hmm. And look, we encourage people, if you think you have one of those stories, or, you know, just tell us about it and hit the website and get involved. And you may well be hearing from us about telling your story.
I've certainly met some interesting people, friends that have gone overseas with donor eggs shipped in, you know, couples going for surrogacy overseas, wanting those eggs from the Ukraine.
And the cost of surrogacy.
Africa. And there were a few altruistic surrogates in Australia. But then again, you go, oh, it's such a dark area. What happens if people change their minds?
And altruistic surrogacy is fine, but it still costs the altruistic surrogate tens of thousands of dollars in lost employment, in medical bills, all those sorts of things. And we don't really have any kind of structure to allow that to happen. We have a case going on in Victoria at the moment, where a couple who had a donor egg implanted in the UK and had a birth which took place in Australia are now trying to go back and import sperm from the same donor so that they can give their child a sibling with a genetic match, that they have the same biological parent. But we can't do that according to the laws in Australia, because that was donor sperm that was paid for, which is prohibited under Victorian law, and possibly with very good reason. But that's the discussion that we need to have, because things are moving very quickly. And as I say, it's been allowed to run its own race for a long time.
From starting back in the early days of sperm donation, where for whatever reason couples were encouraged to keep it quiet, I guess a lot of people having their babies through assisted reproduction have kept it quiet in the past. Do you think that we need to be sort of a bit more forward about coming out in the open with these sort of struggles, or, you know, the ways that we conceive our children, just so to open the doors to make it a discussable option? Because it's still a bit closed doors, isn't it?
It is for a lot of people. And not having been in that position myself, I couldn't say what I would think about it, but like most people, I have very close relatives who have gone through that process. In this case, had been trying for a long time, eventually realised that they needed a donor egg, and they're in the process at the moment of working out how they're going to deal with that. Close family know, but they've decided no one outside close family will know, and what are they going to tell that child when it grows up? We haven't had those discussions. I don't. You know, look, everyone's different. Everyone will feel differently about it. I don't know where we'll land.
I think there's another aspect of it as well, where really shouldn't it be your choice for how hard you want to go through IVF? I mean, it's your money, your body, your hormones, your future, your child. Why should everybody who just got a free range kid be able to contribute to the discussion on how many rounds of IVF you can stump up for?
Yep. And people are stopping, and we know they're stopping. We know that this Victorian review into IVF has found that people are dipping into their superannuation to fund IVF. We spoke with one of the IVF parents we spoke to who dipped into house deposit, used money from a redundancy, and borrowed money from family to have IVF. So that drive is remarkable, and it's only limited by resources and how far people are
prepared. To me, I would hate to think that there was an arbitrary cutoff that wouldn't take into consideration individual circumstances. There is nothing like the yearning for a baby if you don't have one.
Then again, I mean, the argument on the other side of that is, should we be spending those thousands of dollars on people for whom the chances of conceiving is almost zero? Could that money be better spent at the other end on people who are younger, who have a better chance of conceiving, but have perhaps had to stop going through IVF because they can't cope with the out-of-pocket costs, and perhaps giving more support at that end? Now, if you do that, there's an argument that that cutoff would actually encourage people, or it's an incentive for people to go into IVF earlier when their chances are better. But then on the other side of that, there's the sacrificing of career. So we really have got no answer to that at the moment, other than egg freezing and, well, potentially donor eggs. So there's a very, very difficult discussion which is to be had around that. But certainly we know that there have been experts recommending that we do come up with some restrictions on public funding for IVF. But it's got to be more than just a blunt instrument. And, that's what we need to cover.
And I think it definitely needs much more of a input from the women, because, let's face it, we can be as gender equal as we like, but when it comes to the fertility, you know, a lot of the burden does rest on women.
Yes, it's been fascinating for me to be a part of as well, to get that insight into just what decisions people are prepared to make to pursue that dream. Look, I hope people respond well to the report. Some of them are going to be difficult. They're going to be really tricky conversations, but we just think it's time that we have them.
And those conversations will be running this month on abc.net.au/makingbabies. That's the website address, but we will put a link on the Baby Talk website too, where you can also find other Baby Talk podcasts where we have spoken about the subjects like surrogacy, egg freezing, and you can find them on abc.net.au/babytalk, or just by putting Baby Talk into your search engine. If you like listening to your podcasts on iTunes or the ABC Listen app, you can subscribe to Baby Talk and share stories like this one, or last week's podcast, which spoke about a group banding together to help women experiencing complex pregnancies.
And, you know, sometimes it's just not wanting to know, other people that have been through it and have come out and survived it in the end, because it's such an emotional journey for women and their families, and it impacts the whole entire family. So we support them with our peer support program through that, and we also offer our families our practical services. So this way we try to take away the stresses at home.
There are so many great stories in the world of being a new parent, and I love talking about them. And the people that join our online Facebook group include some of the women that Ben spoke to in his research about the fertility industry. You can join too if you'd like to.
Baby Talk isn't just a podcast. We're hatching articles, links, and helpful advice on Facebook too. Like Baby Talk on Facebook and join the community. Just search for ABC Baby Talk.
I'm Penny Johnston, and I'll see you next time on Baby Talk.
ABC Baby Talk is a weekly podcast on ABC Digital Radio, wherever you get your podcasts, and on the ABC Listen app. Like us on Facebook to find out as soon as a new episode is ready. Just search for ABC Baby Talk.